The Mystery of the Blue Train, Agatha Christie. Chapter 10. On the Blue Train.
Dad!
Mrs. Kettering started violently. Her nerves were not completely under control this morning. Very perfectly dressed in a long mink coat and a little hat of Chinese lacquer red, she'd been walking along the crowded platform of Victoria, deep in thought, and her father's sudden appearance and hearty greeting had an unlooked-for effect upon her.
"Why, Ruth, how you jumped!"
"I didn't expect to see you, I suppose, Dad. You said goodbye to me last night and said you had a conference this morning."
"So I have," said Fenalden. "But you're more to me than any number of darn conferences. I came to take a last look at you, since I'm not going to see you for some time."
"That is very sweet of you, Dad. I wish you were coming, too."
"What would you say if I did?"
The remark was merely a joking one. He was surprised to see the quick color of flame in Ruth's cheeks. For a moment, he almost thought he saw dismay flash out of her eyes. She laughed uncertainly and nervously.
"Just for a moment, I really thought you meant it," she said.
"Would you have been pleased?"
"Of course," she spoke with exaggerated emphasis.
"Well," said Fenalden, "that's good."
"It isn't really for very long, Dad," continued Ruth. "You know, you're coming out next month."
"Ah," said Fenalden unemotionally. "Sometimes I guess I'll go to one of these big guys in Harley Street and have him tell me that I need sunshine and change of air right away."
"Don't be so lazy," cried Ruth. "Next month is ever so much nicer than this month out there. You've got all sorts of things you can't possibly leave just now."
"Well, that's so, I suppose," said Fenalden with a sigh. "You'd better be getting on board this train of yours, Ruth. Where's your seat?"
Ruth Kettering looked vaguely up at the train. At the door of one of the Pullman cars, a thin, tall woman dressed in black was standing, Ruth Kettering's maid. She drew aside as her mistress came up to her.
"I've put your dressing case under your seat, madam, in case you should need it. Shall I take the rugs, or will you require one?"
"No, no, I shan't want one. Better go and find your own seat now, Mason."
"Yes, madam." The maid departed. Fenalden entered the Pullman car with Ruth. She found her seat, and Fenalden deposited various papers and magazines on the table in front of her. The seat opposite to her was already taken, and the American gave a cursory glance at its occupant. He had a fleeting impression of attractive gray eyes and a neat traveling costume. He indulged in a little more desultory conversation with Ruth, the kind of talk peculiar to those seeing other people off by train. Presently, as whistles blew, he glanced at his watch.
"I'd best be clearing out of here. Goodbye, my dear. Don't worry. I'll attend to things."
"Oh, Father!" He turned back sharply. There'd been something in Ruth's voice, something so entirely foreign to her usual manner, that he was startled. It was almost a cry of despair. She'd made an impulsive movement towards him, but in another minute she was mistress of herself once more.
"Till next month," she said carefully.
2 minutes later, the train started. Ruth sat very still, biting her lip and trying hard to keep the unaccustomed tears from her eyes. She felt a sudden sense of horrible desolation. There was a wild longing upon her to jump out of the train and to go back before it was too late. She, so calm, so self-assured, for the first time in her life felt like a leaf swept by the wind. If her father knew, what would he say?
Madness. Yes, just that. Madness. For the first time in her life, she was swept away by emotion. Swept away to the point of doing a thing which even she knew to be incredibly foolish and reckless. She was enough Fenalden's daughter to realize her own folly and level-headed enough to condemn her own action. But she was his daughter in another sense, too. She had that same iron determination that would have what it wanted, and once it had made up its mind, would not be balked. From her cradle, she'd been self-willed. The very circumstances of her life had developed that self-will in her, It drove her now remorselessly. Well, the die was cast. She must go through with it now. She looked up, and her eyes met those of the woman sitting opposite. She had a sudden fancy that in some way this other woman had read her mind. She saw in those gray eyes understanding and, yes, compassion. It was only a fleeting impression. The faces of both women hardened to well-bred impassiveness. Mrs. Kettering took up a magazine, and Catherine Gray looked out of the window and watched a seemingly endless vista of depressing streets and suburban homes. Ruth found an increasing difficulty in fixing her mind on the printed page in front of her. In spite of herself, a thousand apprehensions preyed on her mind. What a fool she'd been! What a fool she was! Like all cool and self-sufficient people, when she did lose her self-control, she lost it thoroughly. It was too late. Was it too late? Oh, for someone to speak to, for someone to advise her. She'd never before had such a wish. She would have scorned the idea of relying on any judgment other than her own, but now, what was the matter with her? Panic. Yes, that would describe it best. Panic. She, Ruth Kettering, was completely and utterly panic-stricken. She stole a covert glance at the figure opposite. If only she knew someone like that, some nice, cool, calm, sympathetic creature. That was the sort of person one could talk to. But you can't, of course, confide in a stranger. And Ruth smiled to herself a little at the idea. She picked up the magazine again. Really, she must control herself. After all, she'd thought all this out. She'd decided of her own free will. What happiness had she ever had in her life up to now? She said to herself restlessly, "Why shouldn't I be happy? No one will ever know." It seemed no time before Dover was reached. Ruth was a good sailor. She disliked the cold and was glad to reach the shelter of the private cabin she had telegraphed for. Although she would not have admitted the fact, Ruth was in some ways superstitious. She was of the order of people to whom coincidence appeals. After disembarking at Calais and settling herself down with her maid in her double apartment in the blue train, she went along to the luncheon car. It was with a little shock of surprise that she found herself set down to a small table with, opposite her, the same woman who'd been her vis-a-vis in the Pullman. A faint smile came to the lips of both women. "This is quite a coincidence," said Mrs. Kettering. "I know," said Catherine. "It's odd the way things happen." A flying attendant shot up to them, with the wonderful velocity always displayed by the Compagnie Internationale des Wagons-Lits, and deposited two cups of soup. By the time the omelet succeeded the soup, they were chatting together in friendly fashion. "It will be heavenly to get into the sunshine," sighed Ruth. "I'm sure it'll be a wonderful feeling. You know the Riviera well?" "No, this is my first visit." "Fancy that. You go every year, I expect." "Practically. January and February in London are horrible." "I've always lived in the country. They're not very inspiring months there either. Mostly mud." "What made you suddenly decide to travel?" "Money," said Catherine. "For 10 years I've been a paid companion with just enough money of my own to buy myself strong country shoes. Now I've been left what seems to me a fortune, though I dare say it would not seem so much to you." "Now I wonder why you said that it would not seem so to me." Catherine laughed. "I don't really know. I suppose one forms impressions without thinking of it. I put you down in my own mind as one of the very rich of the earth. It was just an impression. I dare say I'm wrong." "No," said Ruth, "you're not wrong." She'd suddenly become very grave. "I wish you'd tell me what other impressions you formed about me." Ruth swept on, disregarding the other's embarrassment. "Oh, please, don't be conventional. I want to know. As we left Victoria, I looked across at you, and I had the sort of feeling that you, well, understood what was going on in my mind.
I can assure you I'm not a mind reader, said Catherine, smiling.
No, but you will tell me, please, just what you thought.
Ruth's eagerness was so intense and so sincere that she carried her point.
I'll tell you if you like, but you must not think me impertinent. I thought that, for some reason, you were in great distress of mind, and I was sorry for you.
You're right. You're quite right. I'm in terrible trouble. I should like to tell you something about it, if I may.
Oh, dear, Catherine thought to herself. How extraordinarily alike the world seems to be everywhere. People were always telling me things in St. Mary Mead, and it's just the same thing here, and I don't really want to hear anybody's troubles.
She replied politely, Do tell me.
They were just finishing their lunch. Ruth gulped down her coffee, rose from her seat, and quite oblivious of the fact that Catherine had not begun to sip her coffee, said, Come to my apartment with me.
They were two single compartments with a communicating door between them. In the second of them, a thin maid, whom Catherine had noticed at Victoria, was sitting very upright on the seat, clutching a big scarlet Morocco case with the initials RVK on it. Mrs. Kettering pulled the communicating door too and sank down on the seat. Catherine sat down beside her.
I'm in trouble and I don't know what to do. There's a man whom I'm fond of. Very fond of, indeed. We cared for each other when we were young, and we were thrust apart most brutally and unjustly. Now we've come together again.
Yes?
I'm going to meet him now. Oh, I dare say you think it's all wrong, but you don't know the circumstances. My husband is impossible. He's treated me disgracefully.
Yes, said Catherine again.
What I feel so badly about is this. I've deceived my father. It was he who came to see me off at Victoria today. He wishes me to divorce my husband, and of course he has no idea that I'm going to meet this other man. He'd think it extraordinarily foolish.
Well, don't you think it is?
I suppose it is.
Ruth Kettering looked down at her hands. They were shaking violently.
But I can't draw back now.
Why not?
It's all arranged, and it would break his heart.
Don't you believe it, said Catherine robustly. Hearts are pretty tough.
He will think I have no courage, no strength of purpose.
Seems to me an awfully silly thing that you're going to do, said Catherine. I think you realize that yourself.
Ruth Kettering buried her face in her hands. I don't know. I don't know. Ever since I left Victoria, I've had a horrible feeling of something, something that's coming to me very soon, that I can't escape.
She clutched convulsively at Catherine's hand.
You must think I'm mad talking to you about this, but I tell you, I know something horrible's going to happen.
Don't think it, said Catherine. Try to pull yourself together. You could send your father a wire from Paris, if you like, and he'd come to you at once.
The other brightened. Yes, I could do that. Dear old Dad, it is queer, but I never knew until today how terribly fond of him I am.
She sat up and dried her eyes with a handkerchief.
I've been very foolish. Thank you so much for letting me talk to you. I don't know why I got into such a queer, hysterical state.
She got up.
I'm quite all right now. I suppose, really, I just needed someone to talk to. I can't think now why I've been making such an absolute fool of myself.
Catherine got up, too.
I'm glad you feel better, she said,
trying to make her voice sound as conventional as possible. She was only too well aware that the aftermath of confidences is embarrassment. She said tactfully, I must be going back to my own compartment. She emerged into the corridor at the same time as the maid, who was also coming out from the next door. The latter looked towards Catherine, over her shoulder, and an expression of intense surprise showed itself on her face. Catherine turned also, but by that time, whoever it was who had aroused the maid's interest had retreated into his or her compartment, and the corridor was empty.
Catherine walked down it to regain her own place, which was in the next coach. As she passed the end compartment, the door opened and a woman's face looked out for a moment and then pulled the door to sharply. It was a face not easily forgotten, as Catherine was to know when she saw it again. A beautiful face, oval and dark, very heavily made up in a bizarre fashion. Catherine had a feeling that she'd seen it somewhere before. She regained her own compartment without other adventure and sat for some time thinking of the confidence which had just been made to her. She wondered idly who the woman in the mink coat might be, wondered also how the end of her story would turn out. If I had stopped anyone from making an idiot of themselves, I suppose I've done good work, she thought to herself. But who knows? That's the kind of woman who's hard-headed and egotistical all her life, and it might be good for her to do the other sort of thing for a change. Oh, well, I don't suppose I shall ever see her again. She certainly won't want to see me again. That's the worst of letting people tell you things. They never do. She hoped that she would not be given the same place at dinner. She reflected, not without humor, that it might be awkward for both of them. Leaning back with her head against a cushion, she felt tired and vaguely depressed. They had reached Paris, and the slow journey round the Ceinture, with its interminable stops and waits, was very wearisome. When they arrived at the Gare de Lyon, she was glad to get out and walk up and down the platform. The keen, cold air was refreshing after the steam-heated train. She observed with a smile that her friend of the mink coat was solving the possible awkwardness of the dinner problem in her own way. A dinner basket was being handed up and received through the window by the maid. When the train started once more, and dinner was announced by a violent ringing of bells, Catherine went along to it much relieved in mind. Her vis-à-vis tonight was of an entirely different kind. A small man, distinctly foreign in appearance, with a rigidly waxed mustache and an egg-shaped head which he carried rather on one side. Catherine had taken in a book to dinner with her. She found the little man's eyes fixed upon it with a kind of twinkling amusement. "I see, madame, that you have a roman policier. You are fond of such things?" "They amuse me," Catherine admitted. The little man nodded with the air of complete understanding. "They have a good sale always, so I'm told. Now why is that, eh, mademoiselle? I ask you as a student of human nature. Why should that be?" Catherine felt more and more amused. "Perhaps they give one the illusion of living an exciting life," she suggested. He nodded gravely. "Yes, there is something in that. Of course, one knows that such things don't really happen," Catherine was continuing, but he interrupted her sharply. "Sometimes, mademoiselle, sometimes. I who speak to you, they have happened to me." She threw him a quick, interested glance. "Some day, who knows, you might be in the thick of things," he went on. "It is all chance." "I don't think it's likely," said Catherine. "Nothing of that kind ever happens to me." He leaned forward. "Would you like it to?" The question startled her, and she drew in her breath sharply. "It is my fancy, perhaps," said the little man, as he dexterously polished one of the forks. "But I think that you have a yearning in you for interesting happenings. Eh bien, mademoiselle, all through my life I have observed one thing. All one wants, one gets. Who knows?" His face screwed itself up comically. "You may get more than you bargain for." "Is that a prophecy?" asked Catherine, smiling as she rose from the table. The little man shook his head. "I never prophesy," he declared pompously. "It is true that I have the habit of being always right, but I do not boast of it. Good night, mademoiselle, and may you sleep well." Catherine went back along the train, amused and entertained by her little neighbor. She passed the open door of her friend's compartment and saw the conductor making up the bed. The lady in the mink coat was standing looking out of the window. The second compartment, as Catherine saw through the communicating door, was empty, with rugs and bags heaped up on the seat. The maid was not there. Catherine found her own bed prepared, and since she was tired, she went to bed and switched off her light about 9:30. She woke with a sudden start. How much time had passed, she didn't know. Glancing at her watch, she found that it had stopped. A feeling of intense uneasiness pervaded her and grew stronger moment by moment. At last, she got up, threw a dressing gown around her shoulders, and stepped out into the corridor. The whole train seemed wrapped in slumber. Catherine let the window down and sat by it for some minutes, drinking in the cool night air and trying vainly to calm her uneasy fears. She presently decided that she would go along to the end and ask the conductor for the right time so that she could set her watch. She found, however, that his little chair was vacant. She hesitated for a moment and then walked through into the next coach. She looked down the long, dim line of the corridor and saw, to her surprise, that a man was standing with his hand on the door of the compartment occupied by the lady in the mink coat. That's to say, she thought it was the compartment. Probably, however, she was mistaken. He stood there for a moment or two with his back to her, seeming uncertain and hesitating in his attitude. Then he slowly turned, and with an odd feeling of fatality, Catherine recognized him as the same man whom she'd noticed twice before, once in the corridor of the Savoy Hotel, and once in Cook's offices. Then he opened the door of the compartment and passed in, drawing it to behind him. An idea flashed across Catherine's mind. Could this be the man of whom the other woman had spoken, the man she was journeying to meet? Then Catherine told herself that she was romancing. In all probability, she had mistaken the compartment. She went back to her own carriage. 5 minutes later, the train slackened speed. There was the long, plaintive hiss of the Westinghouse brake, and a few minutes later, the train came to a stop at Lyon.